I became inspired a little bit to speak from something, a topic we discussed this afternoon, but to tell a story from Mahabharata at the same time. It's a nice story. I was mentioning some of the many varieties of ideas about the soul. People that say they accept the existence of the soul. And I thought of speaking a little bit about different ideas that people have about reincarnation. Within our large host population here in the West of Christianity, there are groups amongst the Christians who accept reincarnation. I mentioned there was a long time ago King Constantine that didn't like the idea of reincarnation. I didn't explain why. Here's why he didn't like it. He thought if people accepted reincarnation, it's just completely speculation. If people accept reincarnation, the reasoning went like this, then they won't really apply themselves for a spiritual life because they can just do it later. So something like students can relate to. Suppose when you're given the option at the beginning of your course, you can take your final exam when everyone else takes your final exam, or if you like, you can just take it later. I'll take it later, please. Final exam, I'll take it later. So he reasoned that if people accepted reincarnation, not whether is it true or not, but if they accepted it, then they won't apply themselves so seriously. So he sat the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church down and told them, don't come out until you figure out how to get rid of this concept. But I mentioned that there's still some remains. They weren't good editors, or maybe they deliberately left some that weren't so obvious. And there's two references. One is who Saint John the Baptist was in his previous life. I forget that detail. Somebody from the Old Testament that in the New Testament became Saint John the Baptist. Then another one. So it's explicit in the Bible, in the New Testament. Then there's another New Testament reference where the disciples of Christ ask, who is to blame for a man who is blind from birth? Is it his fault or is it the responsibility of his parents that somehow he was born blind from birth? And the Christian theologians, contemporary Christian theologians that analyze it, they have different things to say, of course, because they're theologians, but predominantly they say, those that write about this say, because Christ didn't just reject it, saying, oh, that's rubbish, or how could he possibly be responsible for it? Because the soul begins, in this life, and there's nothing prior to this life. He didn't reject it. For the reason that he didn't reject it, it was accepted as a possibility. Reincarnation. Kind of indirect. But that's something that's, who knows, in the next few years they may edit that out in some way or another too. But one of the presentations that I've made at universities is called the Scientific Basis of Reincarnation. And the introduction goes something like this. George Gallup Jr. at Princeton University did a study in the 80s about how many people believe in reincarnation, and it was a real low number. And then something 15 years later he did it again, and it was a much bigger number. And so there was some question as to why the number went up so sharply. And there were two main reasons given. One is a large influx of Asian population living now in America. And because they accept, so the percentage spiked. And then another is very strong, not proof, but evidence, there's a difference, based upon modern science and findings in modern science that show it's likely, if not compelling. And so, rather than take a whole hour to go through all of that, I thought I would just say what I find amongst all the different scientific evidence that's most compelling is the recent book, or as far as I know, the most recent book of Dr. Ian Stevenson, University of Virginia, a book that's entitled Where Biology and Reincarnation Intersect. Dr. Ian Stevenson is the chairman of a department that's unique. It's one of its kind because he's a specialist in studying past life remembrances. And so I'll just do it quickly. Out of the whole, he has interviewed people and followed up on something like 650 different individual cases. And so out of that whole pie of possibilities, there's a little wedge of the pie where cases reported where somebody's remembering their past life, connected with their past life and this life, is some bodily, biological something to do with their body that's connected to their past life. So here's an example. Somebody, a woman, came with a leg, half a leg, and said to Ian Stevenson in his interviews that in my previous life I died being run over by a train. And when I was run over by the train cut off my leg, half of my leg. And in this life I was born with half a leg. That's pretty biological. You have half a leg. So what he did was he went, first of all, to the birth record to see, did this happen later or was it there from birth? And it was there from birth. Okay. And then from if it's a no, then it doesn't fall into that particular slight wedge of pie. So then, you know, go to the previous life and all the details match, and sure enough they died of a train accident. Sure enough, all the other things, the names of the family members and so on, and details where they lived and their address and their email cell phone number, you know, everything matched. All the details of their previous life. So here's a couple of other ones that are like really embarrassing. One woman was born, he went to Ian Stevenson, showed on one leg there were these indentations around the knees and the leg from birth. And the woman said that in my previous life I was a man. And I had an affair with another man's wife. And when the other man's wife came to find out, he came and he killed me. He tied me up with a rope around my legs and threw me in the bottom of the well and I drowned. And those marks on my leg are from the rope marks when I was thrown in the bottom of the well. That's not very complimentary. So he went to the birth records, and sure enough, those marks were there from the woman's, or the girl's, now woman's, birth. So going to the previous place, did all the research. Sure enough, so-and-so by such and such name died in the bottom of a well. So this person remembered the woman who he had the affair with and the man who killed him. And he, Dean Stevenson got a confession from the man that killed him that, yeah, I killed him. That's not very complimentary. That's not so, you know, conjured up. You know, I just made up a nice story that somebody killed me in my previous life, and he admitted it. And there's a book full of, there's pictures of the people and the marks on their bodies, and here's another one. Somebody somewhere in the Middle East, Semmel something, said that he had a birthmark here and here, and he said, in my previous life, my name was another Semmel, but something else, and I was a thief and a murderer and a plunderer in my previous life, and what happened was, my brother and I, we were doing this thing, and then the people in the place where we lived, they just had enough of us, so they got together a posse and went chasing after us with their guns, and we went running, and they chased us, and we went up on a hill, and they followed us, and we went into a little cabin, and they followed us, and so I realized we were finished, so I shot my brother, and then shot myself, and the bullet went in here and came out there, my previous life. So from birth, I had a birthmark here and here. Not very complimentary. So Ian Stevenson went to the birth record of Semmel, whatever his name was. Sure enough, there was a birthmark here and here. So he went to the place and everything matched. The, you know, the whole story. These two brothers, and he committed suicide. Up on a hill in a cabin and shot his brother. And all the other people and all the details of everything, etc. A whole book full of where biology and reincarnation intersect. So those things you can't even imagine making them up. They're biological. You can't make it up. You can't make up a birth record and have some mark. There's all kinds of different things. You know, somebody whose hand was caught in a factory machine and their fingers were cut off, and then they died of such and such cause, and then in this life they didn't have fingers in one hand from birth, etc., etc. So there's, that's not proof, but it's pretty compelling when you have volumes of those things. Come up with some other explanation. Maybe what? What other explanation? For Vaishnavas, what's even more compelling than empiric evidence like that is scriptural evidence. Give a little example. When Bhaktivinoda Thakur found the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it wasn't the current day Navadvip. We don't go to that place in Navadvip when we're going to Mayapur for a yatra. We won't even go to that place that some people say that's the birthplace of Mahaprabhu on the other side of the Ganges River. Because it's not. But there's some people that their livelihood is based upon saying it is. So they're strongly invested. So when Bhaktivinoda Thakur from Navadvip looked across the Ganga and saw a vision of a very tall, towering, luminous temple in the middle of a rice paddy, he had a vision. And someone was next to him. He showed them, see, and he also saw. He describes this in a letter to his son, Lalit Prasad, just like his son, Bimala Prasad, became Bhaktisiddhanta. He had another son named Lalit Prasad. There's a biographical description of his life to Lalit Prasad, who describes this vision. And so the next day, he marked the spot and went. And when he went there, he couldn't find a tall, luminous temple. All he could find was a piece of land that in the middle of all this agricultural land in West Bengal, it wouldn't grow anything. except Tulsis. Wouldn't grow eggplants, wouldn't grow rice, wouldn't grow anything except Tulsis. So the local villagers considered it useless. And then he asked the local Brahmins, what's with this land? That this is actually the birthplace of Mahaprabhu. But the people over Navadvip don't tell them we said that. But this is the birthplace of Mahaprabhu. And then he studied maps that showed, going back and back, the course of the Ganges had shifted. Then he found in scriptures, according to Ananta Samhita, after Mahaprabhu leaves, the Ganges will shift and the place of Mahaprabhu's birth and pastimes will be under the Ganges for 200 years, and then it'll shift again back to where it was. Thousands of years ago, describing this situation, which happened. The maps show that it happened, just as Ananta Samhita said it happened. So he had all this evidence. But he wanted final confirmation, so he brought Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj to the place. But Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj was so old at the time, 120 or something like that. He couldn't walk, so he was carried in a basket. And when he reached the site, he jumped out of the basket. Haribo, Haribo, this is the place. Spiritual confirmation. That was sufficient. More compelling than all the other evidence that he found. And so he began a very bold exercise of knocking on doors in Navadvip and asking people to give a donation, 1 rupee at least, to build the temple of the birthplace of Mahaprabhu. He was risking his life. West Bengal, livelihood. He was risking his life. And he was a government officer going door to door asking people for 1 rupee. And he built a little place. When we go to Navadvip, we go to the birthplace of Mahaprabhu, and there's the large temple that Bhaktisiddhanta built. But as you're looking at the temple over to the right, 90 degree right, that's the place that Bhaktivinoda Thakur built. It was simple. And then he requested his son, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to build a more substantial temple, which would take many years. It did take many years, and when the funds were there, they began digging the foundation, and when they were digging the foundation, they found an archaeological proof. The deity that Jagannath Mishra, the father of Lord Chaitanya, worshipped, that had been buried in the couple hundred years of being under the Ganges, in the mud of the Ganges, and they were digging the excavation, they found the deity. It's now on the altar. So from our perspective, the most compelling is sadhu, the confirmation of Jagannath Das Babaji, not just because he jumped out of a basket, even though he was unable to walk, but by his spiritual acumen, he knew. Jagannath Das Babaji, just to give you some idea, I'm getting way afield from what I want to talk about. But I want to speak about Mahabharata, but I'm telling you about Jagannath Das Babaji. Jagannath Das Babaji lived in Navadvip, right near the Ganges. And literally right by the bank of the Ganges. And many people would come to see him because he was such an elevated spiritual personality. And so one couple, a business industrialist, very wealthy man, came to see Jagannath Das Babaji and was asking for Jagannath Das Babaji's spiritual blessings. And very oddly, Jagannath Das Babaji held his head down and was holding a stick and was beating the ground with a stick. And the man thought he was angry with him. So he asked, "Have I offended you? You're beating the ground with a stick." He said, "No, I'm chasing a goat who's eating a tulsi plant outside of one of the temples at Radhakund in Vrindavan." So the industrialist gentleman, he knew how to, at the time, it wasn't send a text message, it was, he sent a telegram from Calcutta, from Navadvip to Mathura, and from Mathura he had somebody go to Vrindavan to find out had that happened, and he found out it happened. There was a go at Radha Kund. It was eating a tulsi plant. The very temple was mentioned, and the person, the pujari, confirmed. And he suddenly left. That's Jagannath Das Babaji. He didn't normally show his whatever clairvoyance or mystic power or capacity to be in touch with Supersoul and know things that other people don't know. But he was in touch with Supersoul. He knew things that other people don't know. Like, what's the birthplace of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? He didn't do all the research, the legwork. Bhaktivinoda Thakur did. But he confirmed it. More than the maps and land that would only grow tulsi and the vision. It's the spiritual power that for us in devotional circles. There are, according to the Vedic view, there are three basic standards for knowing something. The Sanskrit word is pramana. And the English word, get ready for bells and whistles, it's called epistemology. Ooh. The means of knowing something. How do you know something? And the means of knowing something is in Sanskrit pramana. So one is pratyaksha, direct sense perception. Another is anuman, reason and logic. You can know something. The classic example of reason and logic is, although I can't see the sun, I know the sun is up because there's light coming through the window. I can't see the sun, but by reason, in a while, the sun's going to go down and the light coming through the window is going to stop. So the sun's down. I haven't seen the sun.